Okay, guys, we'll make a start. It's good to see you. Welcome back. Thank you for coming. Thank you very much for returning if this is your second time to this gathering. And if it's your first, then again, you're all the more welcome. It's really great that you've gathered here. Let me just give you some idea of what to expect today, and then I'll back up and share a little bit about the reason we gather anyway, just to recap on last term, in fact. And then I'll get into this material we have in front of us here. The plan is that we'll have a bit of a break from the meeting I'm not going to give you a time because I probably won't keep to it, but after a while we'll have a break, and then we'll have an opportunity to have a drink, a bite to eat, and we'll get together again. I want to encourage one person here to share a story, a testimony of how God's led him in a particular area of faith and using his creativity in a missional way for the sake of the city. I'm going to ask him to come up and share some of his story after the break. And then what we'll do is get into what remainder of the content that we need to cover. And then we'll throw this open to some discussion. And I think the best way for that to work is that we, again, as we did last time, get into some groups with people sitting around you and pick out one or two of the questions that are thrown in the back of the main section, and just try and get your teeth into those as a means of discussion, a primer for talk. And it may be appropriate by the end of all that to gather again and actually just tease out some of the things that you guys have talked about in your discussions so that we can benefit together from that and see what kind of things get thrown up in the larger group context. So that's the kind of plan we have, and we'll do our best to remain true to it. The goal that we have with all of this is, again, on the front page, as it was last time, set out in these four bullet points, really, to provide an environment for fellowship, support, instruction, and networking. We appreciate that many of you are kind of strangers to each other, as much as you've got gifts of creativity, but you don't necessarily know all the other people in the church who are gifted in the arts or in the specific area where you're working creatively. And it's just brilliant to find a way to network with each other and actually support each other and encourage each other and hopefully help. So that's an important goal. It's a great thing for a church with our opportunity and capacity to really play to its strengths, and actually potentially huge sparks can fly out of just apparently chance opportunities to gather with like-minded people with a spark of gifting and creativity in them. Secondly, to equip saints with the biblical worldview and thus aid their creativity. That's particularly relevant to this session and the last session, where we're looking specifically at issues to do with worldview. I want us to really, as time goes on, really deliberately take the Bible and get to grips with what it positively teaches about creativity, about the arts and beyond, so that we're as equipped as we possibly can be to handle the challenge serving God in a world that doesn't recognize God. The reality is that believers can have true motives and a desire to serve Jesus in the kind of marketplace, but actually lack some of the tools and the systems of thought, if you like, for knowing how that should be done. We can have the best intention, but not realize that the way that we're working, the way that we're operating, is actually, we haven't ever considered how does a biblical worldview affect the way that I do my art, the way I do my creativity? Does it affect it at all? Should it affect it? And if so, how? How does the truth of God's word, how is it brought to bear on this area of my life? And it certainly should be, and so we want to keep investigating that over time. And I trust get inspired by that. Me just starting a ramble at the start of a talk might not be the best way of persuading you that this is actually truly inspiring. So no, I get to think God's thoughts after him and creatively put his, as it were, kind of be his hands of extension, be be his means of communicating his truth to the world through the creative gift he's given me. And to do that well, we need to be confident in the truth of God's word so that we are representing him faithfully. To understand the development of culture, its influences, past and present, that will come up particularly again today. And then finally, to focus on our role in engaging and transforming culture for Jesus. The more practical on that front, the better as time goes on. That's why I wanted to bring up one example today for you to hear from. So there's a bit of a background in terms of the ethos of this. Guys, I hope this serves you and is useful and fruitful in your life. And probably the key thing is that for that to happen is that you're totally engaged, that you're able to jot things down, think things through, ask questions, and really work on this together with me. If you really feel like you'd love to ask a question even in the middle of what I'm saying, you can stick your hand out, that's fine, and it might be there's opportunities for that. I might steamroll you if I'm on a roll. But we'll see. But let me just get on with this. Actually, before I go straight into this recap section, let me just also mention a book or two. I mentioned a couple of books last time, and I know one or two of you went out and got them and read them, and I trust that was helpful. There are great, great books to get hold of. Not enough of them, sadly. There are so many huge areas of what it means to be a Christian, a creative Christian, that need to be investigated more and more. But there are one or two books that are brilliant. One book I'd love to mention to you is a book by a man called Andy Crouch, and it's called Culture Making. It's, I think, published by IVP, and the copy I've got is a hardback one. It may be in paperback now, but it's a very accessible, easy to read, quite an enjoyable book that asks some very difficult questions and brings actually some brilliant answers on how we as lovers of God actually go about this task of creating change in culture and making culture, and what we actually mean by culture, and what we mean by culture making, and actually what we don't mean, because there are lots of people that are out there trying to crusade for Jesus in the world and bring about change, and some of their efforts can be almost detrimental to the gospel. Sometimes they don't help because they haven't stepped back and thought properly and thought biblically about the concepts involved. And so I would recommend his book as a way of thinking these things through. I honestly think it's a helpful, worthwhile read. And actually, although it's full of a lot of theory and kind of theology, it is eminently practical. You could go away from reading it and start, you know, make a list of things that you know you can do now to start sort of progressing in the mission that God's given us. So that's a helpful book. I'll mention as well, just as a slightly different book, but large chunk of it deals deliberately with this whole area of creativity and the arts. And it's a book by Charles Colson, who's also from the States. He's an interesting story himself and a remarkable guy in many ways, but the book itself is called How Now Shall We Live? How Now Shall We Live? And he really deals with this whole issue of worldview, what it means to be true to the biblical worldview, the truth of God's word in a culture that has denied it, and how we should live in that culture, and deals very practically with such things as music, art, painting, sculpture, drama, writing, all kinds of stuff. Especially towards the end, he deals with that. But he deals with it in the context of a heavy, healthy book that's very, very comprehensive. So it's a good book to get. Those two, I could mention others as well, but I think it's good to diet it to two every time. Otherwise, it'll just overwhelm you, and it won't be helpful. So let's just get into this. I'll tell you what, I'll just pray briefly before we do that, and we'll cut into these notes straight away. Father, I want to ask you that you'd make this time very fruitful for us, that you'd stir our hearts and minds, you'd cause us to think differently and more effectively, you'd cause us to be discerning about the world we live in, discerning about the truth of your word, and discerning about our response and how we need to, Lord, live our lives glorifying you, Lord, in this day and age and in this city. I pray, God, teach us as a church to, Lord, be more and more effective at better using the gifts you've given us to glorify you and exalt you And even because of that, to have greater joy in those gifts. Lord, we thank you that worshiping you is not divorced from enjoying. And I pray that all of us would, out of today and all that we're learning and working through and discussing, Lord, actually enjoy the gifts you've given us all the more. In the name of Jesus. Amen. Amen. Well, today specifically, I want to just kind of finish off what I began last time. If you weren't here, it won't matter too much because I'll pick up on it. I'll briefly recap. And look a little bit further at the kind of world that you and I have been thrown into in terms of the ideas that predominate in the average person's thinking. The way that the culture thinks has been shaped. It's not a blank sheet of paper. It's been shaped over decades and centuries of thought and discussion and opinion. And it influences not just the world outside, but often influences the church. The ideas that are popular influence individuals and communities very easily, very simply. And the important responsibility for Christians is to actually not just know the truth of God's word, but know the times in which they live, to know them well. I quoted last time from Chronicles the reference to the sons of Manasseh who knew the times and knew what they should do. And the truth is, it's very hard to know what you should do if you don't know the times. If you only live in the ghettoized context of a kind of religious, churchy environment and don't actually look carefully and scrutinize the way that people outside think, the truth is we're slightly disabled in our ability to engage well and fruitfully. So it's essential for us to know the time, to understand the thought processes, the worldviews behind people's decisions and actions, and discern them and filter them out to know, actually, no, there are certain things that we just need to be on our guard against. There are certain things that we don't need to be on our guard against. We can just embrace, because it's by God's grace that the culture thinks that way. It's thinking the right way. And there are certain things that it's neither here nor there. They're not good or bad. They're just things that you just have to be aware of and make do with. And I think in the context of creative people particularly, this is hugely important. Because the people that shape culture and shape the world that you live in and try to worship Jesus in are creative types, artistic people. And not necessarily conventional artists even, but people who, through their creative gifts, whether it's in journalism even, in education, in media, have huge influence, much more than we may give them credit for, and realistically, much more than often those in political power have. The influence of someone who's got huge range in media is subtly able to undermine someone who has apparent influence because of their political status. And we as those who have the Holy Spirit in us, have an opportunity to use creativity to actually influence the world with the right worldview. But to do that well, it's good to discern the way that the world tends to think. So once again, we're going to dig into a bit of history and just bring ourselves more up to date with what we looked at last time. That means that A, we'll be looking at one or two things from the past that might frighten you in terms of the detail and the big scary words. It's not meant to intimidate you. If you don't understand a big scary word, it doesn't matter that much. Just get the flow of what I'm saying. Don't be too hesitant about, you know, the kind of apparent intellectualism. It's not meant to sound poncy. It's just meant to help us to think. And secondly, I'm going to have to really do broad brushstrokes again. Like I said last time, it's like I'm using a big roller, okay? I'm not using a fine brush. I'm just trying to give the general picture at risk of even caricaturing it, just so that we understand the basic principles of how people's worldviews have developed over time and how we need to engage with the world around us. So let me get right into it and talk about the headings here. The thing we looked at especially last time was modernism, what we might call modernism. And really what we mean by that is the general principles of thought that became popular in the West from about 1600 onwards. And to the point where by the year 1900, just about everybody in the West made the same assumptions about the world, about life, about truth and how to find truth, about right and wrong, about all the sort of things that flow out from those big questions. They basically took up the same general worldview. And even if individual people didn't take up the same basic worldview, the people with influence and power did. So in a sense, you could say that's all that mattered. Modernism reigned supreme. And by modernism, to broad brush treat it, it's really based in the kind of the ideas coming out of what's been referred to often as the Enlightenment, particularly, which was kind of late 17th century, right up to about 1800, where Western man decided that no longer would he be confident in the apparent obviousness of the Bible's truth, the obviousness of revelation, the obviousness of God, the obviousness that Jesus is the Son of God, the obviousness that we're sinful and therefore even our minds are corrupted to the point where we cannot know everything and we need grace in order to be able to know everything. There came a point where basically those with influence just decided against that and wrote books and great logical treatises that really tried to point out that it was time to move on. We're kind of grown out of that. That's a childish phase that the Western man has undergone. And now we are able to deduce for ourselves. We are more confident in our own independent, reasonable minds. As rational Western human beings, we are educated. We have achieved enormous things scientifically. We have dealt with some of our biggest challenges. We can educate our children better. We can deal with public health. We can deal with medicine. We can deal with financial institutions to make them more sturdy. We can achieve huge things on the seas and explore the creation through better and better and better sort of nautical invention. We are supreme. We are the great human race. And really, the notion that there's some kind of God of the Bible that we ought to humble ourselves before is not really that helpful. So, short of paying a little bit of heed to religion out of politeness, the general tendency amongst the influential thinkers of that era was to more or less put God to one side and replace him with reason. Reason being elevated almost as a god in itself. Literally, in some cases, in the French Revolution, they erected monuments to the god of reason and had literally ritualistic events where they worshipped at the shrine of reason. It was a deliberate rejection of the authority of the church and the authority of the Bible. It was replacing it with this God, that humanity's ability to discern, to be wise, to work out his own story according to his own strengths and make the world a paradise because man could do it alone. And that's modernism. And in various forms, it's influenced the way the world's run ever since. And so it's a rejection or an undermining of classical, biblical themes. And the way, if you're thinking, all right, what's that got to do with art? If you were to look, for example, just to use painting as an example for a sec, at certain paintings, certain artists that come about in that particular era, what was at the time revolutionary in the way they did their stuff, these days doesn't seem revolutionary. You know, you go and look at an art gallery and see a painting by like the Spanish artist Goya, and you think, oh, it's just a painting from a few hundred years ago by a Spanish guy, and it shows... For example, there's a famous painting he did of an execution, a firing squad execution during the Napoleonic Wars. And it's a very bleak image of some desperate prisoners of war being executed. and looking desperate and throwing their arms up in shock and horror and fear and anguish. And these faceless bureaucratic soldiers all in a row, you can't see their faces, are just shooting them. And it's a kind of a horrific image, and it's meant to be quite a powerful kind of vivid kind of moment. But what was powerful at the time, more than we realize now, is that really it totally went against the kind of Western tradition of how you present such a moment. In art, you'd normally show, in some way, eternity. You'd show an afterlife. You'd even present it maybe as a kind of martyrdom. There's some justice being done here, or there's some injustice being done here, and God will recompense, and God is rescuing them away. Whereas Goya doesn't really present it like that. He presents it as just a fact, as a bare, plain fact that has no spiritual meaning. It's just an accident of war, and it's kind of empty of any spiritual meaning, positive or negative. Now, as I say, we might look at that and think, well, so what? You know, it's just another painting. But at the time, it was a breaking of rules, if you like. It was speaking a specific message. That would be how it would have been understood. And others of that generation were similar. The kind of themes they started to deal with, well, up until then, it would be much more the norm, normative, even amongst people who weren't particularly godly or passionate about God, to present in their art biblical themes deliberately, not exclusively, but it just would be predominant. You would go back to Bible stories or even stories of classical Rome and Greece and try and bring out of those things morals, points that want to be made, or theological points, points about grace, points about truth, points about God and the Trinity, or something like that. It would be presented, preached almost through the canvas. And what's happening in this era is people almost just denying that and deciding again to choose themes that were deliberately kind of this worldly, if you like, that empty art of any emphasis on grace and really focus specifically on nature. And when it deals with grace, when it deals with a biblical image, a biblical story, art of this kind brings it down, makes it, loosens it from any spiritual meaning. And so there are paintings that some of the great modernist painters have done that deal with biblical stories, but there's something very different. There's not a hint of worship about them. Many of them, there's not particularly any reverence. And sometimes that's very obvious to see. Sometimes it takes a more kind of, a history of art and clever Dick to actually explain that to be the case, in which I'm not. But I read one or two books that explain. And what it represents is a trend that really marked itself on society. And as I say, has done since. And so that's one, I mean, I'm talking about paintings there specifically. One of the great painters of the era of the French Revolution, Jacques-Louis David, painted huge paintings that celebrate, the way they're painted, celebrate the greatness of revolutionary man, of godless man, of man come of age, man free from the past, and really focus in on humanistic ideas of man. Another just way that's obvious that modernism has affected art is in architecture. In more recent times, it's more obvious to see, but I'm talking about, I guess, sort of early 20th century and beyond. In different ways, modernism has affected different sort of disciplines in different ways at different times, but in certain kinds of architecture, which you totally would recognize, and you know exactly the sort of thing I'm thinking as I describe it, where buildings basically look like calculators or toasters, they just look like they are utilitarian things where people are to live, which kind of practically put people in a certain kind of box and function okay. They function effectively if men and women were just basically binary objects, machines that have evolved by chance. And I guess really obvious example would be the mass production of high-rise flats in the sort of post-war era in the UK. That's modernist architecture. It's a kind of architecture that reflects a worldview that sees mankind kind of kind of in a box, kind of reduced to you know, digits. And we know how to control the world. We know how to socially engineer people. We know how to put people into society in an organized, efficient, educated, scientific way. And so we build sort of flats that look like hard drives. And that's where people will be put. Now, obviously, over more recent years, there's massive reaction against that way of building and architecture, and people see the weaknesses of it. But it was characteristic of a certain way of thinking and planning society that was modernistic. It had to do with a way of saying that we can reasonably, according to human reason, make society great in our reasonable way, irrespective of grace and revelation. Now, obviously, there's kind of reactions to that. There's been reactions over the years against this way of thinking. Right early on in the time of the Enlightenment, there were what might be called the Romantics. So you would have heard of poets like Byron and Shelley and Keats and people like that, and Wordsworth and Coleridge. And you'd have heard of artists like William Turner. And you'd have heard of poet artists like William Blake, who it was like they were reacting against the machine age and seeing it as an evil thing, because they resisted the idea that humanity was to be boxed in and limited and to become just kind of just scientific matter. They were saying, no, there must be more to humanity than that. There's the spirit within. And you can't put that in a test tube. You can't explain it, but it's there. And if you deny it, you're denying who we really are. You're controlling us. You're bringing us down. You're making us less than human. And so many of the poets, and even the musicians like Beethoven and Schubert of that era, are kind of emphasizing great themes of freedom and joy and liberty. Liberty for the individual, and a kind of spiritual inspiration for the individual. But here's the thing. It's not really to do with the God of the Bible. So there's a real passion about being spiritual, but there's a refusal to go back to the God who is spiritual. And so it's like we can't deny the fact that we're more than just matter. We can't deny it. We just know it in our gut. And even when we hear, the more we hear modernists and scientists and these extremely intellectual people reducing us, the more we hear them trying to explain the world away, explain our feelings away, explain our passions away through just explaining, you know, chemical reactions within the brain, and the way that your DNA works makes you do that, makes you think that. The more we hear that, the more we react against it, because we know it can't be true. There must be a spirit within. There must be like a ghost in the machine. And people like these that I've mentioned particularly tried to produce art and music and whatever, writing, that gloried in the independence of the human spirit and tried to react against this kind of reductionism. And actually, it's out of that era that you get the concept of genius as it's understood nowadays. Genius in a previous era would have been just the idea of anybody's gifting. Anybody having a genius. Everybody has their own genius. It wasn't a hierarchy. It wasn't like he's a genius, he's just ordinary. She's a genius and she's just run of the mill. It was a sense in which all of us had genius. But through the Romantic era, you get this kind of notion of the heroic genius who rises above the world and makes art and music and so on that maybe the world doesn't totally understand, and maybe the sad people in their suburban lives can't really grasp, but at least we can. And it's kind of makes art exclusivist, it makes it sort of specialist, a bit Gnostic, a bit kind of, you know, you can't get it because you don't have the spirit that I have. You know, like, you know, they say only certain people can really hear Jimi Hendrix. Only certain people, you know. Some of us can try, and we can listen, but you can't hear him. You know, that's just a modern version of a very contemporary version of the same kind of idea. And it kind of flourished through people like these guys. Many of them, like Coleridge, for example, were pretty heavy drug users. Like Coleridge was an opium addict and spent a lot of his time just plastered, stoned out of his mind, but dreaming these gargantuan kind of dreams and then applying them through his great poems that celebrated the idea of spiritual revelation, but nothing to do with God. nothing to do with God. You know, famous poem, Kubla Khan, which is a great, great poem about sort of spiritual revelation, someone having a vision, a dream of a paradise, of a romantic escapist paradise, but it's totally godless. And I'm mentioning it is because although it kind of came about as a reaction about 200 years ago from the prevailing modernism, it's completely relevant to now. I mean, as I'm describing these things, you can probably think right now of not only, you know, maybe people that you know, or, you know, or art that you've looked at, or stories or movies or programs that you watch, which sound like this. There's a kind of romantic kickback against modernism that strangles people and holds them down to just being binary objects and tries to celebrate the spirit, but without the God behind it. And so there's almost like, it's like people are inconsistent. It's like they want to have some kind of spiritual engagement, but they don't want the God who makes that real. And it's like people live in a kind of strange bubble of contradiction. And they have been, really, ever since the power of the Enlightenment influenced the West. So that's Romanticism. But a second reaction is more kind of powerful and fundamental and more up-to-date. Postmodernism, which you could call ultramodernism. It's basically it's modernism to the nth degree. It's like saying, okay, we've rejected the idea of revelation and we've put reason in its place. But what postmodernism does is it says, hang on, we rejected the old systems of the church and the Bible of trying to influence and control society, and we said those things are just oppressive and controlling. We need to be set free. But all we've done is we've just replaced that with other controlling systems. Okay, maybe they're not biblical, but they're still just as powerful and controlling and wicked, like fascism. Like communism. When you realise that since the beginning of the 20th century, it got to the point where about 1960, more or less half the world's population was living under communist control, socially engineering half the human race. So the way that people lived their lives, down to the tiniest detail, was prescribed for them. That's phenomenal. The world, because of modernism, the world was dramatically changed. People came under the control of godless scientific ideas, so-called scientific ideas, social science, that really, if truly, actually robbed them of some of their independent spirit, some of their freedom as human beings. And postmodernism says, look, you've done it again. We've just done it without God this time. So what postmodernism does is it asks questions of every single kind of truth claim. It kind of rejects the idea that there is such a thing as truth. It kind of says that anyone who says they have the truth is on a power trip. Anybody who thinks they know what's right and what's wrong has something to win, has something to gain, is trying to control you. So postmodernism pushes for a kind of radical egalitarianism where people aren't really, there's no allowance for an overriding system of truth. What we might call, just to use another big word, a meta-narrative, which just means a big story. Big stories are not allowed. We just have all our own independent little stories. You can have your story, I've got my story. You have your truth, I've got my truth. Because we're very nervous of one controlling story because that tends to truly control and ultimately will lean on violence to win control. That seems to be the story so much of Western history. So people, understandably, have kind of reacted radically against modernism, even in the name of modernism, in the name of being true to human independence and human reason. Now, again, when it comes to art and stuff, it's pretty easy to see this kind of thing breaking in, even quite early in the 20th century. You look at people like some of the Impressionists and the Cubists who painted. What they paint is radically perspectival. What I mean by that is there's not really, especially in the day in which it was done. These days, when you look at a Monet, a painting of Monet, you know, people have Monet on the wall in their loo. know, poppy fields, and it's a Monet, you know, and it's your grandma has Monet on her wall, and so you kind of associate these impressionists with 20 generations, or you know, at least a couple of generations ago, and it's like they're on the walls in charity shops, and it's pleasant, it's nice, on the side of a tea mug, and it's a Monet, it's pleasant, it speaks of tradition and safety and niceness, tweeness. But you've got to put yourself outside that. When these guys started painting, it was scandalous. Because what they were doing with Impressionism was they were saying that away with objectivity, away with trying to chase after some objective idea of accurate appearance, what we're going to do now is concentrate on independent perspective. And we're going to use just dabs of light if necessary. We're going to create something which, if, in a sense, doesn't actually match reality at all, because we have genuine doubts about if there is such a thing. What we're doing is painting what we immediately see. We're painting the impression, which is why they're called impressionists. It's reducing art, getting away from objectivity, saying that there is no objectivity. There's no truth that holds it all together. We paint what we immediately see in our instincts. We find ways to reduce it to independent instinct. And Cubism, Picasso being the most famous, is kind of that even further down the track. So you've got people whose, you know, two or three eyes, you know, vertically like that, and, you know, people with three legs and bizarre, just strange contorted images that seem weird and it's deliberately weird. And the point that he's making is, look, this is my perspective I'm painting. I'm not trying to chase after some photographic reality here. I'm trying to present immediate impressions and ideas. Now, what they're doing, what people like Picasso are doing was these days is it doesn't seem so radical, but at the time it was tremendously radical. And something of a departure, and something that actually spoke of the where people were at philosophically. And loads of modern art since is just the same. What, these days, postmodernism is expressed in even more kind of, you know, extreme ways, you could say, where you have people who paint with almost like a deliberate, there's a kind of a cynicism, an undermining of anything objective and valuable in the way they paint. So some of you will have seen, I think we actually sent an email out to folks from last time to say, look, watch on iPlayer, watch this documentary that a guy called Roger Scruton did about beauty in art, the concept of beauty. And he spent a little while talking about Marcel Duchamp, who is this artist who in the early 20th century did a sculpture which was a urinal. That was it, the urinal, you know, and that was in this art gallery. And at the time, you know, these days, again, that wouldn't be so weird, isn't it? That wouldn't be shocking, particularly now. But at the time, it was just like a red rag to a bull. It was hugely controversial. But he was trying to make a point. He's trying to undermine the concept of objective beauty. He's trying to say, look, the whole idea that there is such a thing as beauty to be chased after, truth, that is just there, whether we like it or not. Well, that doesn't exist. That's old hat. We don't believe in that anymore. And so really, me putting a urinal on this wall in this art gallery and calling it art, who's to say it ain't? It's up to me. I think it is, so it is. And that's exactly what Tracy Emin said when, I think, I can't remember who it was, David Frost or someone said to her, when she did her bed, my bed, it was her sculpture, I think it was the Tate Modern or somewhere like that back in the 90s. And someone said to her, is this art? Why is this art? And she said, firstly and most importantly, this is art because I say it is. So, I mean, she probably went on to give a couple of other arguments as well, but that was the one big argument. Because I say it is. This is me, my perspective. It doesn't matter about whether you think it's art. Who cares whether you think it's art? It is as far as I'm concerned. And so there's a kind of undermining of objectivity. And it means that people produce stuff that it seems, actually a lot of the time, it just seems to be, there seems to be a kind of cheekiness about it. And the highest value that is aspired to by a lot of artists is being rude, undermining, being anarchic. So someone said, you know, a great quotation, Damien Hirst has nothing to say, and he says it. So, you know, what they really achieve is more, they're really more good at marketing than art. It's more about, you know, getting the crowds to look at you, making an event, stirring up passions and controversy. That's it. If you can do that, that's great. But there's not really a chasing after an ideal, an aesthetic of beauty. And that's a very simple rundown of how these things have influenced art. Let me talk a little bit first, though, besides that, about how these worldviews have actually influenced other things as well, just so that we get a fuller picture. Morality. See, much morality, rightness, wrongness, good behaviour, bad behaviour, still holds the vestiges of a bygone Protestant ethical consensus. What I mean by that is people still think that, basically people still think that marriage is best if it's kept faithfully. Adultery isn't good. It's not a good thing. People still think that work is important, that we should work and not be lazy, that property is important, that we shouldn't steal, that we should take property seriously, that education is important, there's a responsibility to help develop the children that we give birth to, that charity is important, that we should give, that there's an immediate impulse in people to give and to love people and to try and raise charity up as a good thing. Trustworthiness in business, that if a guy says, yes, I will do that, you take him at his word. You don't have to be frightened that he won't do it. These are values that the society you and I live in generally kind of takes as assumptions. But the reason it takes those as assumptions is not because of any kind of system of truth that it believes in anymore. If you reject the God of Revelation, if you reject the idea that there is truth, there's a God who is true, and a God who says what's right and what's wrong, a God who is the basis for all that's good and wrong, good and bad and right and wrong, then really what right has anybody got to say finally what's right and wrong? How can we have any confidence in morality as a separate code? How can you? You can't. It's making it up. Right? But we also benefit from the fact that we like those moral codes generally. We benefit from them, actually. They're useful to us. But sometimes some of them stop being useful to us. Like the value of the sanctity of human life, for example. That would have been pretty much a deal breaker a few generations back. That human life, once it's conceived, either the beginning or the very end of human life, is sacred. And so you don't mess about with that. You don't create an environment where people can just remove human life and say that's just inconvenient, we don't want that. It would have been a deal breaker. Now that's not a deal breaker anymore. We've created a society where it doesn't really matter that much. Because, well, those values have been eroded by time. And so values in society we can take for granted, but we can often take them for granted, not realizing that not everybody actually has agreed on the foundation for those values. And if anything, we're almost trying to enjoy those values on the sly, because we've no right to just assume them as a society. There's an article that I've included in the back of this stuff I've given you, the handout. Actually, there's two articles. And there's one that's from Prospect magazine from a few years back. There's one from the Times more recently. I'd read them later. They're fairly they're heavyweight arguments, but they're both by people who are not Christians. In fact, I think one of them is an atheist, Antonia Senior. I think she's an atheist. What they're saying though is, look, let's be honest about this. We don't really have a very consistent system of ethics and morals, because who's to say? Back in the day when we believed in God, we did have a system. But now we just pick and choose. And the way that we react, she talks about BNP, and it was a time, she wrote it at the time when Nick Griffin was on Question Time, and it seemed like half the nation was talking about it. It was huge. Remember that about 3 or 4 months ago? It was a massive event. And it really got people talking, and it demonstrated the assumptions that we make about morality. The prevailing assumptions about what we know is wrong. And she, as an atheist, is undermining that and saying, how do you know it's wrong? How do you know this isn't wrong? How do you know that isn't wrong? And if we're not allowed to say this, for example, about Islamic law, because, well, that's oppressive against a minority, you mustn't say something against Islam because that's oppressing a minority, does that mean we're condoning those things within Islam which tolerant Westerners think are horribly evil? Like, you know, things like treatment of women. It just seems so, we think, gosh, that's wrong. But we mustn't speak against because also it's just as wrong to be oppressive to a minority. And that's racism to speak against Islam. But then they do things that we don't approve of. And contemporary man gets tied up in knots because modernism felt cute when everybody was basically the same and had their hair parted the same way and walked to work the same and had an umbrella under their arm and a bowler hat. And everybody was basically the same. You could be modernist. You could apply the same rules to everyone, put them in the same block of flats. Simple. Or in the same suburbs, if they're a bit richer. They have a nice class system. Everybody goes to the right school. Everybody takes the right exams. And it's all simple. But suddenly we're in a world which is thrown apart. You know, it's thrown up all kinds of distinctions that we didn't used to know about. And it's made life very inconvenient because we're going by values now that we don't all share. And we could take on one assumption and then realize it's actually not at all consistent with that assumption. But we still believe both of them completely passionately. And that's postmodern morality. So the world is riddled with it. And Christians have the unique privilege and opportunity to demonstrate that we are able to be consistent. In a world that is totally unable to find consistency when it comes to truth and right and wrong, Christians stand out like a sore thumb because you actually are able to say, look, we know this isn't good. We know that is good because God says so. And he has that freedom to arbitrate. He is God. So we live consistently. We know we sometimes get it wrong. We have to read our Bibles more carefully sometimes to make sure we do know what we're talking about. But nevertheless, we acknowledge there's a final authority. And the world doesn't have that anymore. So that's to deal with morality. I'll creep down here. I've covered a lot of things there. Education. How education is... If modernist education... took on the kind of the biblical idea that we need to pass wisdom on. We have a responsibility to pass wisdom on to our children, like in the book of Proverbs, that it's right to do that. It's wrong not to. It's an evil thing not to love our children and pass on traditions, pass on truth, pass on wisdom. Modernism kind of held on to that idea, but obviously applied it to human reason. Well, postmodern educational theory is what I was trained in when I was training to be a school teacher, which basically comes across as the concept where you're not actually allowed to tell children what to think too much anyway. The real goal of education is to liberate them from any constraints and let them find the truth that is right for them. And what's become called child-centered education is much more influential now, much more the done thing. And whereas there's many aspects of that that are quite positive, many things that you think, well, actually, that makes sense. It's good for children to be allowed to flourish and recognize their creativity and their talents and be individuals. There's also an assumption that's made there that there's nothing there that we have the responsibility to equip them, give them. They need to know. There's no body of truth. There's no final right and wrong that we're responsible to actually teach them. It sounds, that's indoctrination. We don't like indoctrination. It's evil. It's oppressive. The Bible doesn't call it indoctrination. The Bible talks about something positive that others would take it to be indoctrination. So, education. Politics. Depolarization. Loss of traditional forms of nationhood. Patriotism is now quirky and ironic. So, a deep lack of confidence in political and democratic system. Profound political apathy. Many under 35s don't vote. No point. So. Politics, again, whereas in modernist context, politics was the be-all and end-all because it was who you voted for made the difference of how society is going to run. Generally, people don't expect much change now. There isn't much belief in big ideas. So nearly every time you hear a politician interviewed on the radio and they talk about, well, now you're becoming right-wing and you're becoming left-wing, nearly always the politicians will say, let's stop talking about right and left-wing. Who cares? That doesn't exist anymore. Those are just old ideas of that's right and that's wrong, that's right and that's wrong. We don't believe that anymore. It's a bit more mushy. We're kind of muddled together. And that's the tendency in politics, because of postmodernism, there's a retreat from systems of thinking that distinguish us from other systems of thinking. Religious interests, self-worship, syncretism and relativism. Relativism very simply means that there is no such thing as truth, that all religions are basically the same, that there isn't a final, yes, this is the answer. Jesus was wrong when he said, I am the way, the truth and the life, because he couldn't be. No one person could be. And syncretism means that we try and combine all the religions together to make one nice collective religion. That's, you know, that suits us for all occasions. Literature, we could talk about literature in all kinds of ways, but I'm just going to rush through these. Painting and sculpture I've already referred to quite a lot. Architecture I've referred to. Music, I mean, we could talk about music from lots of different angles, and there's loads of ways we could talk about the difference between melody and discordance, the way that contemporary music can demonstrate almost a rejection again of a idea of objective beauty, and actually celebrate discordance, celebrate a lack of beauty, and just sheer noise. So a really, really clear, obvious example would be John Cage, I think in the 1960s, did a piece of music. I think it was called something like 4 minutes and 4 seconds or something like that. And what it was he put a tape recorder on, and I think what happened was he went in and opened the lid of the piano, and then at the end of 4 minutes closed it again. And that was the music. And it was, you know, it was really trendy. It was like, wow, that's great. That's an extraordinary thing. That's a development. That's great. But it was obviously some kind of statement about what's objective, what actually are we trying to chase with our creativity. I've just put in a lyric of a song by R.E.M., which is kind of out of date now, actually, but it's a good example of a kind of hunger that it still exists in so many writers, musicians, and so on for truth and ultimate reality. It's religious. The way he writes it is kind of religious. It's kind of spiritual, but it's so empty of any final answer. And it's a very good example of the prevailing mentality when it comes to the things of God and spiritual things. And it's left searching, as I put there, in a sea of postmodern relativism. Even though it's quite a stunning song that actually speaks so truly of people's hunger for truth and life. And there's a couple of quotes there from people who demonstrate the kind of worldview that is typical, it seems, of those who have creative influence in music I guess in all kinds of areas. Interesting there about films as well and TV, and just trying to pick out one or two examples of how these areas are influenced by postmodern worldview. Let me just finish this session, before we have a quick break, by touching on 10 strengths and weaknesses. I'm not going to talk through them. I'm just going to read them out quickly and try and just touch them briefly. These are ways that I think it's helpful to understand the strengths and weaknesses of the postmodern generation. The thing that I'd say to you guys that's important is the way I'm talking now, it could sound like I'm saying we've come from a really good place to a really terrible place, and postmodernism is all wrong, it's all evil, it's all terribly bad. But in reality, there's much about the current condition that's an improvement on other eras and systems of thought. And so it's better to look at strengths and weaknesses. It's better to look at things that are good about the general culture around us, as well as things that are bad, and understand them together and see how they need to be filtered. We need to be wise to them. So what I try to do in these 10 headings is just say things that actually it's good that we can enjoy celebrating from a biblical angle, but also we need to just filter and think through where there's potentially a weakness in the way the world sees it. So the first one, a postmodern generation will love fellowship and community, will not like structure and authority. So the idea of being in community, being around friends, sharing life together, doing life together, is a very precious and valued concept. But what it tends to be try to steer clear of is the idea that within community there should be some kind of order and structure. We'll love relationship, but we'll not like accountability. So there's a reluctance to face confrontation. And generally people tend to try and find a middle way through on almost everything rather than face the confrontation of one thing being true and one thing being false. We try and say, well, let's just try and believe both or try and find a middle ground that means that we don't need to actually stand apart. Even though that comes from a love of relationship, which is a truly biblical value and a great thing to celebrate. So these are all things that are positive, but just as believers we need to kind of hold them biblically with discernment. We'll love equality, but we'll not like role distinction. So equality is a great thing biblically, but within that concept, very often what people do is overstep it and think, well, therefore, because of equality, there is zero distinction between people when it comes to role. There isn't any, no one has any responsibility for another person. We are responsible just for ourselves. And actually, the guy or the girl in a marriage are basically just individual objects that neither one has a distinct role from the other. And that's just to use marriage as an example. There are many other examples where a love of equality becomes actually a blurring of distinctions. We'll love opportunity and experience, but we'll not love responsibility and confrontation. We'll love creativity, but we'll not like doctrine. So creativity can affect even the way we think about doctrine. So we think, well, I like the Bible, this is what I like about it. Or I read my Bible and this is what I see in it, this is what I get from it. And I want to present it this way because this is what I've seen. And potentially lose the objective reality of what is the Bible actually saying here that's true for everybody, whether we like it or not. And we can so treasure creativity. There are many who write as very intelligent Christian writers or preachers, for example, who it seems to me value creativity in an unbalanced way, disproportionately. To the point where actually you're looking for them to come under submission to what the Bible says at some point, and that seems to rarely, if ever, happen. It's much more about making up doctrine as it seems appropriate to me and my culture. And this is where we have to find a balance. The answer is not to say, well, you're not allowed to be creative with the Bible. You're not allowed to be inventive in the way, you're not allowed to speak or write in a way that's poetic or fresh or creative in any way because we just want to be doctrinal and safe. No, there's a balance that's got to be struck, and that's our privilege and responsibility to find. And C.S. Lewis wrote about this in a brilliant essay called Christianity and Culture, which I would really encourage you to read if you can get hold of it. Superb thing on the role of creativity and spontaneity as it fits within discipleship and imitation. That we're in a culture where it says, do not conform to anybody. Do not imitate anybody. The Bible's instruction to us is be conformed by the renewing of your minds and imitate Christ. So there's a kind of imitation and conformity that's totally right, even though our culture is frightened of it. We'll favour dialogue, we'll not like proclamation. So many will say, well, there's so many points of view, no one's got the right answer, let's just not bother with having a right answer on this one. There's just too many points of view. Evangelism conducted on an entirely subjective level, you tried this, now try Jesus. People respond, I'm happy for you, I'm happy for you that you're a Christian, and that's good for you, but it's not good for me. And that's it's a fairly typical way that people will talk. Because really we've reduced things to dialogue. Number seven, we'll love visual information, we'll not like texts. That's a really broad stroke there, okay? I know it's not, you just got to take that as a pinch of salt. I'm trying to make a general point. We'll love contemplation, we'll not like definition. So being contemplative spiritually is great, but defining it down to tight boundaries and categories is not great. You don't draw lines. So I loved it. It's a great example. I found it really funny. I was listening to Paul Whitehouse being interviewed. You know, Paul Whitehouse, the comedian who was behind the Fast Show, and it's just a fascinating interview. But the person interviewing talked to him about, "Are you spiritual? You know, are you religious in any way?" And he said, "Yeah, oh, I'm very spiritual. You know, I often go and sit in a church, just sit in a country church building and just quietly just sit and think and contemplate and meditate. I often do that." He said, "Of course, if a vicar comes in the room, I leave instantly." And I thought it was such a brilliant example of the way the culture's wired, that we really want spirituality. He really wanted it. He wanted to be spiritual. And I'm glad he did. He wanted to contemplate, to stop and think about things. But what he couldn't have is the idea that someone would come in with some authority and define things and say, "Well, okay, you want to be spiritual? Well, this is the God you need to know. This is the God who is spirit, and this is who you were made for." "Oh, no, I don't want that." He runs away from it. So again, it's a broad brushstroke to make a fundamental point that I think is very true of a culture. We'll love empathy, we'll struggle with objectivity. So I think as a generation, we're generally better, much better than previous generations at empathizing, at feeling other people's... there are signs of it. There are signs of a willingness to listen, to feel emotion together, to be more empathic. And it's a positive thing. But it can be at the expense, if we're not careful, of objectivity. And that can be a threat and a danger. More at home with emotions, but less accountable with them. So we much more happy to be emotional, much more happy to be in that kind of relationship than, you know, previous generations. Sons would return from the war and go to their fathers and say, "I'm back from 6 years away fighting the Germans and living through horror, or in, you know, against the Japanese or something." And their father would say, "Well done, son," shake them by the hand, and never ask them what it was like, and never talk them through the pain, and nothing, no empathy, no exchange of emotion, nothing, just total dark blankness. And people thought that was normal, that was acceptable, that was being sensible, reasonable. I know that all of us would think that's just terrible. It can't be right. You're supposed to share life and feelings and empathize. And we've gone that way. We've done better in that. But we potentially could misconstrue it and turn things into a celebration only of emotions without ultimate reality, objective truth. And lose objectivity. Finally, may have individual vision but not corporate vision. So we live for our own personal ambitions, our own personal career, rather than a corporate bigger story. Whereas people in years gone by would have lived for, you know, fought for modernistic ideals, waved flags for their nation or their ism, their communism or their fascism or their British Empire, their British flag, laid down their lives even for that. There's a retreat from that and a much more interest in individual vision. I really live for my own purpose, my own story, my own big plan in life. So that's a very quick summary of some values that have got into our culture. Now, I'm saying it because as creative people, we just need to be able to discern the reality, the kind of worldviews that are behind society, and know how to tackle them. And so that's a big, big kind of broad picture, but I hope helpful for putting down some foundations. We'll come back in a moment and talk a little more and perhaps discuss things a bit further in terms of how they apply to us. Let's have a bit of a break, and thank you for listening. That's the longest session. The next session will be very short, I promise, and we'll speak then.